From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. It's Here and Now. Coming up, the mayor of Denver visits the mayor of Amsterdam and a pot shop there to see how the Dutch do legalized marijuana.
But first, today President Obama made it official and introduced the woman who he wants to head the Department of Health and Human Services, Sylvia Matthews-Burwell, who's currently the head of the Office of Management and Budget. The announcement came after last night's news that the current Secretary of Health and Human Services, Kathleen Sebelius, is resigning. And during today's announcement, the president praised Sebelius for her work.
There are 7.5 million people across the country that have the security of health insurance, most of them for the very first time, and that's because of the woman standing next to me here today. And we are proud of her for that.
Well, Sebelius's tenure will be remembered for the rollout of the Affordable Care Act, which is being described today as tumultuous, rocky, disastrous, just to name a few of the descriptors. NPR's Scott Horsley joins us from the White House with more on today's announcement. Hi, Scott.
Good to be with you, Jeremy.
Well, the president said this morning that Sebelius had come to him in March to tell him about this decision to step down after the first open enrollment period. So was this voluntary or was she forced out?
Well, the White House is billing this as a voluntary departure, that something that the secretary herself suggested. But obviously, there have been a lot of people calling for her or someone to take responsibility for that rollout last fall. What the White House says is it would have been a huge distraction had Secretary Sebelius left during that six-month open enrollment period when they were trying to get the website up and running again. As it was, she was pretty well sidelined from the technical side of the operation as of, say, late October. That's when the White House brought in a team of outside technical experts to get the website working again. And they succeeded, really. Much to a lot of people's surprise, and by December, certainly by January, the website was working properly, and so then Secretary Sebelius spent the month of March, along with many other members of the cabinet, barnstorming the country, doing promotional events, trying to drive people to the website, and of course, as we heard the president say, as of now, the sign-ups top 7.5 million. He did misspeak though a little bit when he said that most of those are getting coverage for the first time. The poll suggests it's not necessarily most or of the people who joined coverage on the website are getting coverage for the first time. But 7.5 million is still a number that the White House is very happy with.
Well, and if that's the secretary calling, Scott, by the way, you're welcome to pick up the phone. So what about how she will be remembered? The president actually brought up something that had nothing to do with the health care law, which was that one of her first acts was to deal with a flu vaccine and pandemic flu, that idea. But is it going to be just about the health care law and the rollout, which many are already not looking very kindly upon?
You know, she will be remembered. I think that will always be one of the first things that's talked about. But it's going to depend on people's perspective. The president did talk today about the bumps and bruises that he has and that the secretary herself has. Certainly, it was a bruising effort to get the Affordable Care Act through the Congress. Remember, it passed with zero Republican support.
Right.
There were battles along the way about policy provisions. One of those is the contraceptive mandate that insurance policies must provide women with access to birth control. That remains controversial, and it's the subject of ongoing litigation before the Supreme Court. And then, of course, there was the self-inflicted black eye of the non-functioning website. So will all that be forgotten in the long run? The White House certainly hopes so. Just yesterday, the president was at the Lyndon Johnson Library recalling the similar controversies over Medicare back in the day when that was being pushed. And Secretary Sebelius noted today that her father was in the Congress at that time.
Yeah.
They would like it to be that the Affordable Care Act is once viewed as, you know, as much a part of the American fabric as Medicare is. But will we have to wait 50 years to get to that point? You know, we're only 6 months in, so hard to say.
Well, let's talk about the person that President Obama would like to succeed Kathleen Sebelius, and that is Sylvia Matthews-Burwell. What can you tell us about her?
Well, she served throughout the Clinton administration in various management positions, and then she worked for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the Walmart Foundation. She was brought back into the White House to serve as budget director and was unanimously confirmed by the Senate just about a year ago. So the president said he doesn't think too much has changed since then. He expects an easy but he expects her to be confirmed by the Senate in her current role.
Well, and I saw, by the way, that John McCain already tweeted today support for her, said she was a great choice.
That's right. Some Republicans have applauded her choice. She was instrumental in negotiating the two-year budget deal, a bipartisan budget deal. So she's well received on Capitol Hill. And what the White House is really underscoring about her resume is her skills as a manager, as someone who can implement this law, which still has a lot of implementing to do.
Because she's not a healthcare person per se. She's really more of a manager.
She's not steeped. She's not waist deep in healthcare policy. Although as White House budget director, she certainly had a role in overseeing the budgets of Medicare and Medicaid. So she does know a good deal about healthcare policy.
NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley. And Scott, I hear the announcement was in the Rose Garden, but really right now it's just tulips.
Beautiful day here in Washington, D.C.
All right, Scott, thanks.
My pleasure.
Colorado, of course, recently legalized recreational marijuana. And today, Denver Mayor Michael Hancock is in the Netherlands talking with the mayor of Amsterdam about lessons learned from that city's famously liberal marijuana rules. Rules, however, that recently got stricter. The Netherlands, for example, now bans tourists from the so-called coffee shops where pot is sold, although that restriction doesn't apply in Amsterdam. But the city has forced coffee shops near schools to close during school hours. Mayor Michael Hancock joins us from the line from Amsterdam to tell us what he's seen and hearing there. Mayor Hancock, welcome.
Thank you.
And we should note from the get-go that you opposed the legalization of recreational marijuana in Denver, but you're now having to implement it and deal with any intended or unintended consequences. So I assume this is a very important and interesting trip for you.
Yes, it's very important given the recent decision by the voters of Colorado to legalize marijuana. And, of course, in Denver, we began to implement it as of January 1st. So this is important. We're learning some lessons as well as sharing some that we picked up.
So give us a sense of what you feel like the Dutch have gotten right, whether it's on the crime front, on the health front. What are they doing well?
Well, they clearly understand the marijuana industry. You certainly see the shops. You may even get a whiff of it every once in a while, but it's not something that's overwhelming. If a tourist doesn't want to come in contact with it, they don't have to here in Amsterdam. So that's, I think, very important. And a lot of states and cities that may be looking to implement it would be wise to take time to understand what the impacts of legalized marijuana in Amsterdam have been. They understand it. They do a lot of analysis and studying of quantitative and qualitative data. And, you know, quite frankly, they got it right with regards to zoning, how you kind of relegate the consumption of marijuana to the coffee shops. And some of the stuff we've tried to emulate there in Denver is to be very restrictive of where you can consume this, the product, as well as who sells it and those sort of things. But they, you know, they've been doing this for 38 years, and they recognize they still have some things to learn and place, you know, areas in which they can get better.
What kind of ways do they feel like they could get better?
Well, I think not to allow the industry to get away from them. We entered the market very restrictive. What you see kind of the rollback here in Amsterdam, I think, is directly related to the fact they think it may have got away from them a bit.
And that sounds like there may be a really key lesson there for Denver. So when you say it got away from them a little bit and they have to kind of rein it in, what wasn't going well and they felt like we need to reevaluate?
I think the proliferation of the number of stores here, the close proximity to the schools was a challenge and is a challenge, and they're dealing with it, it sounds as if. As well as really a desire to have a different perception of what Amsterdam is all about. And that's been the issue in Denver, in Colorado for that matter. Those of us who may have not supported the amendment when it was ultimately passed by the voters was really about how do we protect the image of our state and our cities, that we maintain the important industries such as tourism, and that people feel safe and they don't feel like they're going to be inundated with marijuana smell and things of that nature. So those are some of the lessons that they picked up on and certainly some of the lessons we came out of the box thinking about.
Mayor, on this trip to Amsterdam you're on, have you had a chance to actually go into a coffee shop?
I did. I had a chance to visit with a owner, operator here, and we spent some time, quite a bit of time actually, in a great discussion about her role. She's been an operator for over 30 years, and she imparted some tremendous wisdom.
What kind of wisdom do you think you learned from that shop owner?
She mentioned about the importance of a very close relationship between and clear directives from the government to the operators, and, you know, be mindful of the taxation policies and making sure that you don't send the consumer back underground. These are things that a couple of them that we had thought about, but certainly these operators become a player within your economy, and it's important to hear their voice.
You referenced the financial impact of recreational marijuana, and I believe that in the first quarter of this year, Denver brought in $700,000 in tax revenue from recreational marijuana.
Yes, those are the initial forecasts at this point.
So how do you reconcile your concerns about recreational marijuana with the financial benefits it brings to your city?
Well, you must also balance that with the increased regulatory framework that has to go in place in order to manage the industry. We're going to require new inspectors or additional inspectors. We still don't know what the impacts are with regards to our police department, fire department, impact on our streets with regards to people driving under the influence, campaigns to keep kids away from drugs. There's a lot that we have yet to figure into this, our health facilities and things of that nature. So, and we don't know those yet. So while we may see, are able to calculate today the revenues that have been flowing into the city through via tax, we still have yet to be able to calculate really what the impacts have been, and probably won't be able to know that for quite some time.
Does this still feel like uncharted territory to you?
Listen, I'm very, very proud of my city. It's uncharted in that you only had Amsterdam out there, really, and as they were making changes, I think it was important to try to understand some of their lessons learned. We'll see how it goes. I still have a lot of concerns about our children and their access to this drug, and making sure we properly educate them.
Michael Hancock is the mayor of Denver, Colorado. He's been speaking to us from Amsterdam, where he's meeting with city officials there about marijuana rules in the Netherlands. Mayor Hancock, thank you.
Sasha, thank you so very much. Have a great day.
If you pay any attention to fashion, you know that new styles often make it from the runway to retail clothing racks in what seems like warp speed. It's called fast fashion, and it's radically changed the cost, the quality, and the risk of producing the clothes we wear. Christina Moon studies this industry. She's an assistant professor in the School of Art and Design History and Theory at Parsons, the new school for design. And Christina joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
And Christina, for people who aren't as familiar with the term, would you first define fast fashion for us in your terms?
Sure. Fast fashion is very inexpensive, very cheap clothing that follows the latest trends in fashion and designs that you see off the runway shows. It's really something that has only really emerged within the last decade. And if you can just think of retailers like H&M and Zara, and in this country, Forever 21, these are all retailers that carry very, very trendy, they call it disposable clothing, that's incredibly affordable, that's sold very cheaply.
You're actually making me think of a story related to H&M. A few years ago, the first H&M opened up in downtown Boston, where we're based. And I remember somebody I work with saying, the clothing might only last for three or four wears, but that's okay, because I only want to wear it three or four times. So is that kind of exactly the business you're talking about?
That is exactly it. And you've just really perfectly summed it up. It's really, I think, has really changed our relationship to clothing. And we no longer really go out there to buy things that will last. We kind of walk into an H&M knowing that what we'll buy for under $50, for even $15, may not last, may fall apart in the washing machine. You may only wear it once, but it's okay because you've spent not so much money on it.
So just how quickly can clothes go from the design stage to actually being sold in stores? What's the timeline?
Well, this is what's so remarkable to me about fast fashion, is they're able to have these designs and styles immediately every single day on the retail floor. And a lot of the manufacturers I speak to, they say that they've been able to collapse this very complicated global production, design and production of fast fashion from what used to be a 3-month cycle to now just 2 weeks.
2 weeks?
2 weeks. That means there's somebody who's thinking up of the design and sketching it. They have sample makers who are actually creating the mock-up for it. It means by evening they're on Skype with other countries, factories in places like China, and they're coordinating this global process overnight in 24-hour cycles in 2 weeks' time. They will either ship it or air it back to the U.S. and have it available to folks immediately.
That is really incredible when you think about the steps required. I mean, as you said, from design to production and manufacturing to shipping and logistics and wholesaling and marketing, and you're saying in 2 weeks all of that can happen.
Yeah, and what has really changed is now these manufacturers are actually designing themselves. And so they need to actually have these designs and styles within their warehouses and within their showrooms by the time the retailers actually call. So that when a store like Forever 21 calls up the retailer and says, I received your lookbook or I looked online to see what new styles you have. I'm going to order, you know, however many thousands or hundreds, thousands of pieces of this one particular style in these colors and sizes. That manufacturer can say to them, well, it's sitting in our warehouse right now. We'll have it all packed and shipped for you. You know, truck it out by this afternoon. That's one of the ways in which fast fashion is disseminated so quickly.
That is really incredible. How is that kind of speed even possible?
That's the really fascinating part, I think, of this story. When I actually went out to Los Angeles and started to talk to folks, what I realized was that many of these manufacturers were families. And it turns out that you have two generations normally working within the business. You have an older generation, the parents, many who've had 2 to 3 decades of experience actually manufacturing garments. But what they really lacked was a sense of fashion. And that's where kids come in. What I thought was so fascinating was to see the coming together of these two generations. You have on one hand an older generation who knows everything about the actual garment, has connections to different factories across the world. And then you have this younger generation with perfect English, perfect language skills, an American, quote unquote, an American cultural sensibility. They have knowledge of the fashion world. They have knowledge of the designs, of what's trendy.
So these children of immigrants bring a kind of American sophistication to their parents' kind of know-how of the trade.
Absolutely. I mean, they bring so much to the table. And I will say that in interviewing these families, they say they can't work without the other. The parents need this younger generation because they know so much of the fashion world. But this is also an incredibly cutthroat business. It creates such slim profit margins. It's an incredibly, incredibly risky business to enter into. And for that, you really need to have, from what this younger generation was telling me, you really need to have that older generational knowledge and those connections to be able to succeed in such a competitive business.
And Christina, you also made the really important observation that this fast fashion trend comes with great shift in who bears the risk, and that there are high stakes on what clothing styles will be big hits, and it's possible to gamble wrong.
Absolutely. I think that when we think of the fashion industry, we often think of the designers, and then we think of, you know, factories in another country like China, as if we can just, you know, phone call the factory and say, make me 1,000 t-shirts of, you know, so-and-so. And that's just actually not the way that the fashion industry works. It's actually incredibly complex. It involves so many different kinds of people. And this community in LA is just one link of this larger, larger, complexly global process that I'll say, you know, there's risk at every level beneath the very top of the food chain, beyond, you know, the top companies like H&M and Zara and Forever 21. The folks who are working within this community, they liken this industry to gambling. There's a lot of bad feelings in the district. It's highly competitive. And it's because, you know, retailers set the prices, set the standards. You have to be able to produce a design before it actually hits the larger market that's going to sell. And so you have to have a lot of trust among the people that you're working with to create designs that'll sell and ahead of the game. And I think that a lot of what we don't see, although we do hear of these, you know, the rags to riches stories of a company like Forever 21, I think there are just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of these small mom and pop manufacturers that never do succeed.
Christina Moon is an assistant professor in the School of Art and Design History and Theory at Parsons, the New School for Design, and she directs a master's degree program in fashion studies there. Christina, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
And if you're a fan of the hot sauce sriracha, you may be disappointed to hear that this week the city council in Irwindale, California, declared the sriracha factory a public nuisance. For months now, residents have been saying the odor from the factory burns their eyes and throats. Frank Shong has been following the story for the LA Times. He's with us now. Frank, welcome.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Well, what does this public nuisance vote by the city council mean for Hoi Fong Foods, which makes sriracha?
Well, the city has already sued sriracha, Hoi Fong Foods, in Los Angeles Superior Court, and a trial date is set for November. They also decided to add this public nuisance designation as insurance. So what this means essentially is that they will adopt a resolution at a later meeting, and then Hoi Fong will have a certain time period, and then city law authorizes them to go in and make the changes themselves. So not exactly a shutdown, just allowing the city to go in and enter the factory.
So meantime, the factory continues to make the hot sauce.
Yeah. So right now, all they're doing is mixing, bottling, and packaging the hot sauce. They're not grinding the peppers. You know, in case anybody's afraid there's going to be a shortage, you know, they store enough sauce base to make sauce for 18 months in the giant warehouse out there.
Tell us a little bit about this factory. Does it employ a lot of people there? Is there an economic reason to keep it going, even if it is causing a public nuisance, as they voted that it is?
Well, they have about 60 full-time employees, but seasonally they can get up to 200 people employed. This is a really big, large new factory. When it was under construction, it was the largest building in LA County under construction. It won several, you know, redevelopment awards. The city was extremely proud of this building. So, yeah, it's definitely something that is important to Irwindale, and I think Irwindale city officials, you know, recognize that.
Well, is there any question about whether it should move outside of Irwindale?
You know, that would be pretty difficult because, you know, sriracha sources its peppers to a farm in Ventura County. They've been working with this guy for years and years and years, you know, having him adjust the spiciness of his peppers. You know, that's not necessarily an operation that could be moved. You have different soils. In addition, David Tran's a pretty old guy, and this factory is sort of the crown jewel in his company. You know, he's proud of it. He helped design many different parts of it. This is a building that he's attached to, I think.
Frank, in your reporting of this, have you experienced the problems of the spices that are coming out of the factory, the odors?
Well, actually, that was the first thing I tried to do. I went to the factory, I walked around, and they took me up to the roof of the factory where you know, they were grinding peppers at the time, and spicy air is just pouring out of this spout up there. And I stuck my head in there, you know, took 4 or 5 deep breaths. You know, it wasn't pleasant. I don't want a cologne like that, but it definitely didn't, you know, cause me to have heartburn or asthma or any of the things that I was talking about. Now, my own, you know, experience of the smell isn't sufficient evidence. You know, people could have asthmatic conditions. People could have different respiratory conditions. You know, the smell affects different people of different ages in different ways.
So what's the next step, Frank?
Well, basically, the city council is going to adopt a resolution. Then Hoi Fong Sriracha will have 90 days to make the changes. Hoi Fong had promised to submit an action plan within 10 days and design the filtration system and have it installed by June 1st. So maybe there's some light at the end of the tunnel.
Frank Shong, reporter with the LA Times, talking with us about the Hoi Fong factory in Irwindale. That's the factory that makes the sriracha hot sauce. Frank, thanks so much.
No problem.
An update now on that deadly bus crash north of Sacramento, California last night. 5 high school students, 3 chaperones, and both bus drivers killed when a FedEx truck crossed the median on Interstate 5 and collided head-on with the charter bus, which was filled with students on their way to tour Humboldt State University. Investigators say the truck driver may have been trying to avoid a passenger car when it swerved out of its lane into the oncoming traffic on the other side of the road. Student Jonathan Gutierrez was on the bus. He told the Today Show he was lucky to escape with just minor injuries.
When the impact hit, I flew from my seat to the seat in front of me, and that caused the cut on my eyebrow. And then from there, I realized that we were in a bad accident and the entire aisle was full of smoke, and that's when students were trying to escape the tour bus.
Well, somebody on the bus kicked out a window, enabling others to escape before the bus burst into flames. At a press conference this morning, Assistant Superintendent Earl Perkins with the Los Angeles Unified School District said that 19 students on the bus are from his district.
We have crisis counseling at all the schools we've mentioned, working with the school principals, have their crisis teams available to assist all those who are in need.
Well, meanwhile, Mark Rosekind with the National Transportation Safety Board spoke this morning at a news conference. He says a go team of investigators is rushing to the crash site to collect evidence.
We're going to be investigating the human, the machine, and the environment. And what's critical for us, especially in highway accidents, is for us to collect perishable information, the kind of information that goes away very quickly.
So again, 10 people dead from this crash, many of them participating in a program that helps low-income or first-generation college students visit campuses.
The fastest cruise liner ever made has not moved in 17 years. The SS United States was built in 1952, when ships were still the main way to get across the Atlantic Ocean. To this day, no passenger ship has crossed the Atlantic at a faster clip. The SS United States, the SS stands for steamship, by the way, still has the record, 3 days, 10 hours, 42 minutes. Today, though, it's a gutted, rusting shell floating off a pier in Philadelphia. But it has attracted the attention of best-selling author and illustrator David McCulley. He's making the SS US the subject of his next book, and in doing so, may end up giving the old ship a new life. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, WHYY's Peter Crimmins has our story.
For 40 years, author-illustrator David McCulley has been making architecture and engineering understandable to children, and better yet, to their parents, too. In titles like Cathedral and Pyramid and The Way Things Work, he illustrates cross-sections of complicated designs showing the guts of buildings and technical structures. For his next book, he started to think about the entire history of invention. But that was too much, so instead he settled on shipbuilding because he says ships are the culmination of a great deal of engineering of many different kinds.
It's a way of consolidating all this kind of random information that seemed to be getting out of control, and I was just buried under it. I loved it all and couldn't think of a reason why I should make a book about it. I needed to tell a story of some kind.
The story he found was his own. McCulley himself sailed on the SS United States in 1957 when his family immigrated to America. He was 10 years old.
We're going to go this way. Eventually.
The ship is now gutted. Everything that could have been ripped out has been. Only the infrastructure holding up the steel deck floors remains. There is rust and flaking paint on everything.
This is first class dining, and this is where the band played.
McCulley's looking down from the bandstand on a bare floor underneath a high domed ceiling.
This is as lavish as the space got, I mean, in terms of luxurious double height space.
The SS United States was one of the most luxurious cruise liners of its day. Passengers included Salvador Dali, Marilyn Monroe, Walter Cronkite, Dwight Eisenhower, the Duke of Windsor. Even the Mona Lisa crossed the Atlantic on the United States. It was the fastest way to get across the pond. In fact, it still holds the record for the fastest Atlantic crossing by a passenger ship. It took McCulley almost 5 days to get from Southampton, England, to New York.
But this is the movie theater. This is the room in which I spent most of the voyage.
Oh, really? Watching movies?
Yeah. I was in here with or without my sister. If I could ditch her, I ditched her.
McCulley is not just here to go down memory lane. He is looking at how this ship is made. It was designed by the naval architect William Francis Gibbs, who grew up watching boats being launched in the Philadelphia shipyards. In order to make the strongest, fastest passenger boat possible, he built the hull and lower decks out of steel and the upper decks out of aluminum. Now that all the walls, fixtures, and interior decorations are gone, McCulley can plainly see the ship's bare structure.
Well, you'll see some of it. You'll see this, the grid of columns that runs throughout the whole ship and through all the decks, just like any building. except the foundation floats under it all.
The SS United States was built to be completely fireproof. Everything was made out of metal. No wood was allowed anywhere. An exhibition of objects from the SS United States is now on view at the Independent Seaport Museum in Philadelphia. The curator is Elizabeth Lewis, and she points out the mid-century Art Deco lamps, clocks, and signage.
Everything is aluminum. And in fact, William Francis Gibbs, the architect, wanted to even get a Steinway piano in aluminum. But the Steinway company convinced him that what they gave him would not burn down.
Lewis is not just a curator. She's also a member of the SS United States Conservancy. That's the organization that saved the ship from being scrapped for the time being. And now that it has the ship, the Conservancy is trying to figure out what to do with it. It's hunting for a developer who can turn it into a sustainable project, like a retail and restaurant destination, or maybe a museum, or maybe a unique housing development. And while it's doing that hunting, it's paying about $60,000 a month just to park it here, along Columbus Boulevard, across from IKEA. The Conservancy is headed by the granddaughter of architect William Francis Gibbs. Her name is Susan Gibbs, and she hopes the forthcoming David McCauley book will be a real shot in the arm.
The book, however, will come out in 2015, and so our real challenge is to make sure that the ship is still with us by the time this book comes out.
To write and illustrate that book, the 67-year-old McCauley is scrambling around the derelict ship like a boy playing hooky from school. He's climbing around the shafts of the engine room and spelunking the catwalks of the smokestack funnels. And he regrets that he did not do this when he was an actual boy. At 10 years old, living on the ship for 5 days, he was more preoccupied with coming to America than with the ship taking him to America.
This is so sad. You know, the stuff that would have triggered my imagination was... it didn't happen with that machinery for some reason. I'm a little surprised. So that's been one of the joys of doing this project. It's been like learning about stuff that I really should have learned about then.
McCauley looks at the bones of this ship and sees generations of inventive engineering coming together in this one powerful display of speed and pride, and that's the real story he wants to tell. For Here and Now, I'm Peter Crimmins in Philadelphia.
So, what are your thoughts on cover songs like this one?
I'm gonna rip myself a house in the shade of the freeway. I'm gonna pack my lunch in the morning and go to work each day. And when the evening rolls around, I go home and lay my body down. And when the morning light comes streaming in, I get up and do it again. Amen. Say it again. Amen.
That's Lucinda Williams performing the classic Jackson Brown song, The Pretender. It's from the new Jackson Brown tribute album, Looking Into You. Bonnie Raitt, Keb Moe, and Lyle Lovett also contributed to the two-disc CD. And it got our pop culture critic Renee Graham thinking about tribute albums in general. She is with us now. Renee, first, what do you think of this song?
This is one of Jackson Brown's best-known songs, but what I really like about this is, in the original, there's almost an oddly sarcastic edge to it, as if we're supposed to judge the subject. And the way Lucinda Williams does it, it's really devastating. She makes it really poignant as a hymn. It almost has a gospel feeling to it. And so by the time she gets to those final lines, it's really a lamentation. There's a real sadness to the song that I don't think even Jackson Brown captured in his original.
Are you there? Say a prayer for the pretender. You started out so young and strong, only to surrender.
Although you always face that question when you're listening to tributes about whether the original was better.
You know, it's hard not to go into the comparison thing,
yeah.
You know? I mean, there's sometimes when, you know, a cover song completely misses. And other times, cover songs can be great. You know, Aretha Franklin's Respect is a cover song.
Really?
It's an Otis Redding song. Jimi Hendrix's All Along the Watchtower is a cover song. So, you know, you can get some really good things from cover songs, but the person has to bring the right attitude to it and not just turn it into karaoke.
Well, The Pretender is a song that is so tied to Jackson Brown. Another one is Running on Empty. And on this CD, it is performed by Bob Schneider. Let's listen to a little.
Running on.
Running on empty.
Running on.
Running by.
Running into the sun. I'm running behind.
I don't know. It's so weird to hear it sung by someone else. What do you think?
Here's the thing. I appreciate what Bob Schneider tries to do. He turns it into a folk ballad. But what he misses in his version is what Jackson Browne brought to it, which was, it's a rock song. And the way he does it, it catches you off guard. The way he sings it, it's like, you know, you're zipping down the California coast and it's beautiful, but you don't realize that that car you're in is heading for a cliff. And it's this really sad song about disillusionment and getting older and the loss of youthful ideals. And you hear that completely in Bob Schneider's version, but it's more of a gut punch the way Jackson Browne does it, because you're sort of bouncing along and then you listen to the lyrics and you realize this isn't a happy, upbeat song. This is really a song about sort of the desolation of getting older and how the person you thought you were going to be is the person you're never going to be.
Well, there are a couple of other tribute albums that came out late last year that we should mention. For example, singer Reese had the EP last year, Refried Mac, where she gives us her spin on Fleetwood Mac. Let's listen to a little of her doing Fleetwood Mac's The Chain. It sounds a lot younger.
Well, sure. I mean, the song was probably originally recorded almost 40 years ago. You know, she sings funk, she sings rock, she does a lot of dub in her music. There's all kinds of things that she brings to this. You know, it's a rock song, and it's actually really more of a sort of a ballad, really, in the way that Fleetwood Mac does it. But it's a rock song, and she really gives it this sort of hard funk edge, which isn't going to work for everybody, but I appreciate the fact that she's really trying to take this song in a vastly different direction. If you're going to do the same thing, then what's the point? We can listen to the original on Rumors. We don't need someone else doing it. But I think I like the idea that she goes into this feeling that, you know, I can bring something else to this song and make this a new song for a different generation.
Okay, well, let's listen to what she does with Rhiannon, the famous Stevie Nicks song. Takes like a sky, like a bird, flying. Who won't you be a lover? All your life, you never seen a woman taken by the wind. Would you stay if she promised you heaven? Will you ever win? Wow, a very original take on that.
I think what's really interesting here is she's sort of deconstructing some of these songs. She's obviously a Stevie Nicks fan. She knows what she wants to bring to these songs, but she really wants to sort of pull these songs apart and almost like turn them inside out a little bit. And she strips down a lot of the music, and, you know, there's this sort of off rhythms, there's interesting drum rhythms going on. She brings a lot of very interesting things into this song that I think even people who like the original could certainly appreciate.
We're talking tribute albums with Renee Graham, and you're listening to Here and Now. And Renee, you also like Foreverly with Green Day lead singer Billy Joe Armstrong and Norah Jones. It's a reinterpretation of the Everly Brothers' 1958 album Songs Our Daddy Taught Us. Tell us more about the album.
You know, when people sort of hear Norah Jones and Billy Joe Armstrong from Green Day, they think this should automatically be a disaster. But this isn't the Billy Joe Armstrong of American Idiot. This is the Billy Joe Armstrong who sang the song Good Riddance, or as people know it, you know, Time of Your Life. You know, he can sing a ballad. He knows how to sing quietly and softly. And even though they don't sound like the Everlys, it's remarkable how well their voices blend. What they've done, interestingly, with this, it's a tribute album, but it's about one album that the Everlys did. They completely remake the album. And, you know, it's a challenge because the Everlys were known for these absolutely shimmering harmonies. And for the most part, I really think that Norah Jones and Billy Joe get it right.
For example?
Oh, So Many Years. You just listen to the harmonies, and if you close your eyes, you could almost just think you're listening to the Everlys. All these many years I've loved you, no one has ever known. No one has ever.
Wow. Wow, that is new?
That's not the Everly Brothers. That is not the Everly Brothers. That's Billy Joe Armstrong and Nora Jones.
That's good.
This is what they're doing here, and that's what the real challenge is. It's not just, okay, we're going to sit up here and we're going to do a version of Wake Up Little Susie. They don't do that. They really go into what for the Everly Brothers was this very stripped-down version of their music. And I think for Billy Joe and Nora Jones to take that on, you know, it's a big challenge, but I think they absolutely need it. This is a really lovely, lovely album.
Well, what about the argument that if you love these songs so much, why not just listen to the originals?
Well, sure, you can always do that. But the idea is for music to always be breathing and being reinvented. And that's what people really attempt to do here. It's not to say that every tribute or every cover song works. A lot don't. But when you take a song and you have an artist who really understands what the song can be and can take it to a different level, you end up with something really special. So I think there's always room for tribute albums and for cover songs.
Well, Renee Graham, thank you so much as always.
Thanks, Jeremy.
I swear on way I slipped on a little white lie.
This, by the way, Sasha, one of my favorite covers, John Mayer doing Radiohead's Kid A. A very unusual pairing there.
Exactly.
We do want to take a moment to say a quick goodbye now to one of our producers, Catherine Gorman, who's been with us for 2 years. She is moving on to a new career in design. Catherine, we will miss your energy, your humor, your knowledge of all things Russian, and love of all things Baltimore, or I guess as you would say, or might say, Balmore. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This is Here and Now. Funding for Here and Now comes from the Institute of Contemporary Art. New shows on view now by artists William Kentridge and Nick Cave, ICABoston.org.